And then to add to all this comes the greatest heroes of all time, Iran. You see, they promoted the revolution, the Islamic revolution, for so many years. And we all were excited and we helped Iran. Oh, the Americans want to stop the nuclear weapons. And the Americans are doing this and the Americans are doing that. The biggest devil in this war, and I'm saying devil like it is Iran. You measure according to Quranic standards. And the bigger devil than that is those that call themselves liberation movement, freedom fighters, fighters for the cause of Palestine, Hezbollah. Their name is now Hizb ut-Shaytan.
One of the most confounding questions about events in Syria revolves around the role of Iran and Hezbollah and how these, together with the Assad regime, purportedly represented an axis of resistance, an anti-imperialist front against American and Israeli interests. On the ground in Syria, we find a sentiment that is poles apart from this. Amidst the fall of the regime, there is absolute elation among Syrians we meet that the country has washed its hands of Iran and Hezbollah. The crimes wrought by Iran and her allies in Syria run deep and inevitably have hardened the attitudes of ordinary Syrians towards them.
Again in Darkush, the same young ones took us to the center of the city. They said, we just pushed back Assad's army a few weeks ago. Come to the mosque. And they took us to the mosque and the bomb had fallen through the mosque. You Muslim? You call our Islamic revolution in Iran? Your revolution allows you, your Quran allows you to bomb mosques? Because I don't know which Quran you're using. My Quran doesn't allow me to bomb mosques. Nor does it allow me to bomb religious sites or hospitals and innocent people. My Quran doesn't teach me to fight, support oppression. It teaches me to fight oppression and injustice. My teams went to a mosque. The mosque that was. Because a few weeks previously, the bombs fell exactly at Jummah time while they were reading Salah. And 120 Muslims got killed. This is the Islam of Iran, of Hezbollah, and of Assad. What Hezbollah's had in a place called Homs, they have slaughtered 270 women and children, cut their throats and burned them alive. They did the same in Damascus, they did this 1,000 people in Tarsus, and in Crusade as they fell, there was no way you could take the injured people out. And they cut the water and they cut the electricity. The Islam of Hezbollah of Iran and Assad. While I'm speaking to them, a lady comes walking from far. And from the corner of my eye, I get six sense telling me, this woman is coming to me. And then she looks me in the eye, she say, can I talk to you? I said, you speak English? She said, yes. I said, what's your name? She said, my name is Nood. She said, I'm the English teacher. Then she said, why doesn't Assad fight the fair fight? Why doesn't he inform us that he doesn't like us when we must leave the city? So we will leave. No, his soldiers just walk in and they fire at random, killing women and children. Then the tank shells come and then the missiles come and we die in these huge numbers. All these women and children. Can you see any terrorists here? And we move out in that numbers. And then she said, Assad has no compassion. Assad is worse than Israel. Can you imagine an Arab saying that? Can any Arab, imagine any Muslim, for any Muslim saying that? She said it. And it was said with a passion, the way the lady said it.
When contrasting these crimes with the militant rhetoric of these entities and an image cultivated as anti-imperialist warriors, the inconsistencies are jarring.
Iran made a big noise. Bahrain is a predominantly Shia state. And the Sunnis are a minority. Why are they in control? For Iran's information, Syria is a 15% Alawite state and 85% Sunni state. And the Sunnis did not get up and fight all the time. In 1982, Hafiz al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, wiped out 35,000 Sunni Muslims. He just shot them down. In 2011, the people of Syria walked through the streets. These are Sunni Muslims. They walked through the streets calmly and saying, they didn't say, we 85% want to replace your 15%. All they said is, we want a better system of government, better freedoms, better democracy. Women and children walked in the streets in Al-Darah. And 3 hours later, Assad's security police came and took the children away, 10 to 12 of them, 8 years old, 10 years old, and 12 years old. Took them to the prison and pulled out their nails and burnt them and tortured them. And when the parents went back to ask for these children to be released, they said, leave these children. You have other children, or make other children with your wives. And if you can't make other children with your wives, we will make them for you with your wives. This is the Iran, the Hezbollah, and Assad that we want to protect and defend? No, there's an American plan, you see? They want to make Assad strong to make Israel weak, make Assad weak to make Israel strong. Where is your concept? This is a straightforward case of oppression and injustice. And people are standing up to fight against an oppressive government. It's a straightforward thing. I'm not saying that all Shias are bad. I'm not saying that all Alawites are bad. And I'm not saying that all Sunnis are good. I'm saying that Iran and Hezbollah and Assad are making this a sectarian war. They're hoodwinking the world to say everything is against us. It is not true. This is a pure fight against injustice and oppression, and they're hoodwinking the whole world. And we fell for the bait.
Syrians despised the actions of Iran and Hezbollah because they were truly counter-revolutionary and came to the aid of Assad for years when his fall could have been imminent.
You know, the Assad regime was defeated years ago in its original form. It was defeated by 2013, and then Hezbollah and Iranian militias from all over the world were brought in to prop it up. By late 2015, even that hadn't worked, and Qasem Soleimani had to go to Russia, to Moscow, to ask Putin to intervene. And then the superpower Russia's air force came in and acted as Assad's air force and bombed the hell out of Syrian cities and Syrian civilians. And it said it was going in to fight ISIS, but over 80% of its bombs landed in territories where there was no ISIS. The revolution was supposedly crushed. Assad was held in power by ISIS, which captured land from the revolution, land which the revolution had liberated at vast expense. ISIS then took from it. It was held in place by Russia and it was held in place by Iran.
Today, we are taken for a tour of the Yarmouk refugee camp in Damascus, where the doublespeak of the Assad regime and its allies on Palestine could not be more apparent. 14 years ago, Yarmouk was one of the most desirable neighborhoods in Damascus. A refugee camp, yes, but one that had transformed from an informal tented community of Palestinian refugees to a district in Syria's capital that attracted people from all walks of life. Today, it is unrecognizable. The 1948 Nakba displaced hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Many sought refuge in neighboring countries, and around 70,000 sought refuge in Syria. Most Palestinian refugees settled in Damascus's Alliance Quarter. Kapar, a Syrian body managing Palestinian refugee affairs and coordinating with UNRWA, allocated land for a temporary residence, leading to the creation of the Yarmouk camp, which then grew to be a vibrant hub of Palestinian life. Unlike neighboring countries, in 1956, Syria gave Palestinians almost exactly the same rights as Syrians, allowing them to be employed in all sectors. That allowed Yarmouk to flourish. Assad and his father Hafez also allowed some Palestinian factions like Hamas and Islamic Jihad to operate from Damascus. This air of hospitality came crashing after the revolution, when many Palestinians in Syria joined hands with the revolution against Bashar al-Assad. As a result, in 2013, the Yarmouk camp became the scene of fierce battles between Syrian rebels and the regime's army. After it fell into opposition hands, the camp was besieged by Assad, and it became a favorite target of Assad's air force and the Russian jets aiding him. Assad's siege on Yarmouk was infamous. A photograph of thousands of residents queuing for food in its shredded streets became one of the war's defining images. As we drive around street after street of scenes of utter destruction, hollowed out apartment buildings, demolished masajid, and piles of debris, there's but one description that we all agree on. This is undoubtedly another Gaza. the Palestinian residents of the camp, who have the greatest authority to speak on the subject, see it in exactly the same way. Palestinian Syrian Juma Ahmed Al Aina says residents can't escape making comparisons with Gaza. The same kind of evil we witness in Gaza, he says, was done to Yarmouk. Bashar is the student of Israel.
Look to these camps. Look what Bashar al-Assad did it. He destroyed all the camps and killed the Palestinians. Same scenario of Gaza. Bashar al-Assad like Netanyahu. They work the same ideology and they have same mentality. Look, Bashar al-Assad in media say that Palestine, Palestine, Viva Palestine, Viva Palestine, will defense on Palestine. But in the fact, he destroyed Palestine and killed Palestinians.
Attacks by the Assad regime on Palestinians were not limited to Yarmouk. Over 5,000 Palestinian refugees fled the Al-Latakia camp after a 2011 Assad military attack. A report by the Syrian Network for Human Rights in 2020 highlighted that Palestinians in Syria faced the same severe restrictions as other Syrians, including arrests, torture, and bombardment. Whilst other shadowy parties such as ISIS also committed transgressions against the Palestinians, 87% of all violations against the Palestinian refugees of Syria came from the Assad regime. The vastly different approaches by the regime are telling. Despite decades of Israeli occupation of Syrian land, Bashar al-Assad hardly ever directed his military power against Israel, whilst his allies had only done so to a limited extent. To the contrary, Assad, with his allies in Iran and Hezbollah, deployed their full military might to suppress fellow Syrians and indeed Palestinians. Amidst the eerie backdrop of crumbling buildings in all directions and echoes of our voices, we spot some signs of life. A trio of school children walk towards us in high spirits. They are among the few Palestinian refugees who decided to return to Yarmouk. Their account is one of the camp barely being inhabitable, with access to water and electricity presenting the biggest challenges. Elsewhere in Damascus, on the slopes of Jabal Qasiyun, we are shown the site of a fresh Israeli bombing that occurred post the fall of the regime. The brazen Israeli raids on Syria since December 2024 and its rapid theft of additional Syrian land also make for interesting reading.
Let's go back to the weapons. What Israel used to do was bomb Iranian and Iranian militia weapons.
Hezbollah,
in
yes.
Syria. Hezbollah in particular. Anything which possibly could be transported to Lebanon and then used against them, they destroyed it as soon as they could. Anything that was being transported through the country or was being kept in a store in Syria for passage to Hezbollah was bombed. But they didn't hit Assad's weapons. They didn't hit the Syrian army in general because they knew that the Syrian army was not to be used against them. They knew that the Syrian army was designed to be used against the Syrian people. So they were quite happy with that. It's also interesting to see when they started bombing the Iranians. If we go back to, a bit less than a decade ago, it was when the revolution was finally driven out of the Damascus suburbs, when Douma and other Harasta and other towns like that in the Ghouta were cleaned of the revolution. That's the point at which there was a dramatic uptick in Israeli bombing of the Iranians. When the Iranians were necessary to make sure that Assad stayed in power, then they kind of left them alone a bit. But as soon as it became clear that, no, the guy is now safe in his palace in Damascus, then they upped their bombing of Iran. Now, of course, the Iranians have left Syria now. They've been driven out. The revolution has got rid of them. Alhamdulillah, we've been victorious and we've cleaned our territory from the Iranian militias and as we have from the Russians. And what happens? The amount of bombing has vastly increased. Overnight, I believe the Syrian Navy was completely destroyed. They're not just hitting army and military sites. They're also hitting documents. Hijra al-Jawazat, the passport office in Damascus and the customs office. Now, what is that about? Documentation, documents, buildings full of documents have been burnt by Israeli bombs. Now, I really get annoyed by conspiracy theorists and people speculating, so I'm not going to speculate too much, except one can presume, therefore, that there is documentation which somehow implicates Israel, perhaps the United States, Israel's backer, probably showing collaboration with the Assad regime, that they are bombing the Syrian army, the Syrian navy, the Syrian air force, all of Syria's planes and helicopters are being hit in order to leave the country defenseless now that it's achieving self-determination, and now that there may be, inshallah, an independent government that represents the people there. And they're also getting rid of documentary evidence of something.
As the dust settles over Syria's war-torn landscape, one truth remains stark. While Assad and his allies claim to champion the Palestinian cause, their actions revealed a brutal hypocrisy. The devastation of Yarmouk, the systematic targeting of Palestinian refugees, and the unrelenting oppression inflicted upon Syrians expose the reality behind the rhetoric. Even as Israel expands its occupation and intensifies its attacks, the Syrian regime and its allies had inflicted far greater suffering on their own people. The betrayal of Syria's Palestinians by those who once paraded as their protectors will not be forgotten, nor will the struggle for justice wane in the face of such duplicity.